There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery, which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits. Thus says the control voice, which begins the classic science fiction television show, The Outer Limits. Weekly episodes that sought, as most science fiction does, to transport the viewer to a different realm, where our assumptions and conventional wisdoms are turned inside out and upside down. In one episode of the newer version of The Outer Limits, humanity and an alien race are at war. A human soldier is captured by the reptilian-esque race. The reptiles seek confidential information, but the human won't divulge it. The aliens begin then with a devious plot to transform the prisoner of war through physical and genetic procedures into one of their own, whom they will plan on simply dropping back on Earth, which would spell certain death for her. From time to time, the prisoner is brought into contact with another human going through the same procedure. We see each of them in various stages of transformation, differing degrees of human and reptilian skin covering each of them. The second prisoner seems to be much closer to being complete. Slowly, bit by bit, the two prisoners bond. In a moment of complete openness and vulnerability, the first prisoner shares the vital secret that the aliens desperately want to know. And to her shock and horror, she discovers that the one with whom she has shared these state secrets is not a human being transformed into a reptilian alien, but a reptilian alien being transformed from human likeness back into his natural reptilian state after serving as a spy against the humans. Entering worlds of aliens and space travels and all of the accompaniments is a way for us to examine the human condition. People readily suspend their disbelief, not too far, but they are willing to let reality bend a little. And as they are sucked in by the story, they connect with the characters and the plot, and sooner or later, wham! The twist comes. The twist that delights and makes the story worth it for the reader. While predictable stories get published, you can only take so much. The grand masters of science fiction were skilled storytellers who knew everything had to be set up just right. The readers brought into their narrative so they just felt part of it. And everything logically laid out according to what was expected, but then leaving enough room for the unexpected to creep up on us and blindside us without us ever knowing it. They all did it. Philip K. Dick, Isaac Asimov, Ursula Le Guin, Rod Serling, and many others. So many of them playing with our sense of what should and should not be happening, providing twists and turns we throw around to light all of our human foibles, forcing us to wrestle with the directions or the questions of human existence. Who is in control? What does family mean? To whom are we attached? What is the point and meaning of life? These stories might appear to be only about laser blasters and testosterone, but they are stories of relationships, restoration, and redemption. To this list of fantastic stories that bring us in and then twist and turn until we are brought to a point where we must recognize that things are not as they might seem, I believe we must add John's account of Jesus. After all, the first chapter of John that we hear so often around Christmas seems to have more in common with the opening scene of Star Wars. As we imagine those bright letters scrolling up the screen against the dark, starlit sky, Chapter 1, The Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But then everything settles down and things seem familiar. John uses familiar settings for Jesus. Jesus does familiar things. But Jesus begins to say things in John that are a little more cryptic than in the other three Gospels. John talks about his, or Jesus talks about his coming hour. He talks about being lifted up. And if we haven't been clued into this interesting language that Jesus uses, but are hearing them for the first time, or if we have heard them over and over and simply take them at face value, we might think this language is classic messianic language. After all, he says in chapter 12, which we heard a few weeks ago, "And I, when I am lifted up," that is, exalted as Messiah and King, "I will draw all people unto myself." And he's right. As the promised one of Israel, he will draw Jews and Gentiles to himself and will indeed be exalted, lifted high, and set upon his throne. But we need to be ready, because things are going to move and shift in a bad direction for Jesus soon. Because Jesus has said and acted the way he has, provoking the religious and political authorities, popular opinion might be with him for a little while at least, but the tide soon shifts. Jesus finds himself arrested and put on trial by both the Jewish leaders and the Roman authority, Pontius Pilate. And these authorities, seeking order and not necessarily justice, condemn Jesus to death. And throughout the story, the people seemingly in power over Jesus cling to the claim that has been made about him. They mock him with the title King of the Jews, relishing in all of the pain and abuse that they can mete out as they scourge him, dress him in purple robes, mock him, question him, and finally nail him to the cross. But throughout it all, the loyalties and claims of the people around him are made clear. The Jewish authorities betray their own confession of "the Lord is King" when they call out to Pilate, "We have no king but Caesar." Pilate, as the representative of the superpower Rome, who claims to have power over the life or death of Jesus, is faced with a challenge when Jesus said, "You would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above." Jesus refuses to acquiesce to the notion that Caesar is the ultimate authority in the world. And ultimately, our notions of what is happening are flipped on their head. For just as Jesus challenges the authorities, we too are challenged to see not humiliation in the cross, but the beginning of Jesus' exaltation, the exaltation that was promised. While Pilate cries out, "Here is your king," while the soldiers dress Jesus up and slap the twisted crown of cruel thorns upon his head, bowing to him in mockery, they are unwittingly making a true confession. And he is exalted. He is lifted up upon the cross. Things are not as we expect. Here, on this cross, we see Jesus enthroned. John challenges our every notion of who Jesus is, why he is important. Jesus, as the long-awaited and promised king, vanquishes the ruler of this world not through might and conquest, but through a means of worldly humiliation. And Jesus' followers begin a new kinship, as Mary is given over to the beloved disciple to be mother to him and him son to her. Our following of Jesus, our obedience to him, our identity as the church, the people of God, flow literally as water and blood from Jesus' side, evoking images of baptism and Holy Communion. Our identity as the church has its origins at the cross. According to one biblical scholar, what happens at the cross reveals God's design for the church and should forever define the mission and life of the church. In Jesus' death, we see the true control of this world, not in the powers of this world, not in worldly might, not in power and authority, but we see the true control exercised in humility and laying down one's life. The pattern of Jesus' life and death is the life to which we are called, for it is out of this event of the cross that his control is seen, and that God's way, not our human ways, are made known. Thanks be to God. Amen.